Dr. King said that there comes a time when silence is betrayal. We will not be silent. We will not allow this war to continue in Iraq.
Peace for our family, peace for our country.
We can stand back and do nothing, or we can protect our republic from abuse.
It is not a business agenda, it is not a power agenda, it is a human agenda in which we offer an alternative.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Hundreds of thousands of Americans from Maine to New Mexico took to the streets over the weekend to voice opposition to a war against Iraq. And today, the Bush administration cranks up its pressure on the UN to pass a newly worded resolution to attack Saddam Hussein. Three out of five UN Security Council members, France, Russia, and China, threatened to veto any resolution that is not two-pronged. They want Iraq to have a chance to comply with weapons inspections before any force is authorized. And if Baghdad fails to comply, France, Russia, and China want the UN Security Council to meet and consider military action in a second resolution. The U.S. and Britain are pushing for a single resolution that includes the use of force if Saddam fails to comply with weapon inspectors. The debate, however, has forced the U.S. to make some concessions. Dr. Rahul Mahajan, author of The New Crusade, America's War Against Terrorism, says the debate has forced the U.S. to make some concessions.
For example, in the very first initial drafts, the U.S. wanted to use the phrase all necessary forces, and the resolution mandates the use of all necessary force if Iraq doesn't comply. This was very clearly an attempt to claim that the resolution would then authorize any U.S. military force at any point they saw fit. And so nobody, except of course for Britain and a few of the smaller countries, wanted to go along with that. That's been taken out. There's current wrangling over two phrases that the United States wants to keep in its draft resolution. One is that it would find Iraq in material breach of past UN resolutions, and other countries, including France and Russia, see the phrase material breach as once again being something that the United States can then use to claim that it's a trigger, that it automatically gives the United States the right to use military action. There's also some wrangling over the phrase serious consequences. The United States wants to say that Iraq will suffer serious consequences. Russia does not want that language in because, again, it sees it as the same kind of trigger. So in more details, you know, the United States has essentially wanted to create a new inspection regime, which is far more than just inspections, which really amounts essentially to an indefinite military occupation of Iraq. So it allows the inspectors in the draft resolution, for example, to create what it calls air and ground exclusion zones, no-fly and no-drive zones, which in the original draft they said could be enforced by member states, which would mean, of course, that the U.S. military, that's how they would construe it, that the U.S. military had the right to essentially set up these exclusion zones anywhere in Iraq at any time, which is another way of saying a military occupation. So that phraseology about member states has been taken out. They've made many compromises like this, but several countries still see the resolution that they're trying to push forward now as being something that, again, the United States can just claim is a trigger and that it gives them the right to make war.
Well, we saw reports last week whereby some 50,000 U.S. troops have already begun amassing in the region. It sounds like the U.S. is pretty confident that they're going to need those troops and that there is indeed going to be a war. Why amass 50,000 troops in the region if you don't intend to engage them?
Well, you know, occasionally Bush says some kind of, frankly, nonsense about how he hasn't decided, when the entire tone of the last several months has been a massive propaganda offensive to build up support for the war against Iraq. Right now they're saying very clearly that the efforts in the UN may fail, but that they will go to war anyway. Bush is saying this practically every day. So they are planning to go to war. The timing of that war, when it starts, is really going to be determined by their military considerations and not by questions about international support.
You mean things like the fact that they need to have the war begin by December, or January, or February?
Exactly. They need something in that time interval. They need to have their troops massed. They need to have all the material ready. It's taken them a long time to rebuild stocks of precision weapons, many of which were exhausted in the Afghanistan war. So that's been determining timing, and I think it's hard to guess, but a lot of people are now saying January.
So we're looking at possibly a January start date for this war.
Quite possibly. Could be earlier. You never know. But they seem to be as firmly committed as ever.
And one of the main points that the Bush administration is using for going to war is the fact that Saddam Hussein poses a threat to the region.
Nobody in the region seems to think so. It's very funny. I mean, most countries in the region are either clearly in opposition to the war or simply in lukewarm support because the United States has pressured them. Presumably, they're not any stupider than the rest of us, and if they don't think there's a threat, it's not likely there is. One of the very strange things is that Bush has been pushing the idea that Iraq is a threat to the United States. He even went so far in a speech on October 7th as to claim that Iraq could send unmanned aerial vehicles to attack the United States, even though it's well known that those things have a range, effective range of only a few hundred miles. I mean, he's been trying to build up this in fantasy case that there's some threat from Iraq when his own people, when he says Iraq might threaten us with a biological or chemical weapons attack, so we must go to war. CIA Director George Tenet tells the Senate that the risk of a biological or chemical weapons attack is almost nil, except if we go to war. So the case really at this point, there is no case, and any literate person can refute it. The main thing is the congressional resolution, even though technically we lost, it was a major victory for the anti-war movement because we got 133 people in the House and 23 in the Senate to vote against it, something you couldn't have dreamed of even a month before the vote was taken. If the United States gets a Security Council resolution, which is at best a 50-50 shot right now, it won't be over then either. The anti-war movement is building. It's got to understand that this is going to be a difficult fight and a difficult process, but that none of these other things, signal an end to it. If the U.S. gets its Security Council resolution, all that means is more of a need to get out there and mobilize.
Dr. Rahul Mahajan, author of The New Crusade, America's War Against Terrorism. Mahajan says it will take a lot more with a clear articulation of what the political consequences are to President Bush before he can be deterred from going to war. U.S. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia addressed the crowd of well over 100,000 gathered Saturday at the rally in Washington, D.C. She thanked the late Democratic U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone of Minnesota for being an example of a true warrior and a patriot, leading the fight for health care, education against discrimination, and for fighting against the war. When good men say nothing, McKinney said, evil triumphs. We are here today, so it cannot be said that the good people of the United States of America did nothing in the face of evil.
The good old days are gone, but the bad old boys remain. And dangerous changes are taking place daily. Even after a jury found that the FBI went too far against Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney, their families still don't have justice. The USA Patriot Act and the Secret Evidence Act erode our constitutional rights. Hard-earned savings of generations of Americans are being spent on the military and intelligence communities, while poverty and homelessness affect millions in every city in America. And now this administration wants to take us to war against Iraq. Yet all across our country and those of our allies, veterans of the last war against Iraq, still will suffer the health effects of Gulf War syndrome. Our Vietnam-era veterans still suffer from exposure from Agent Orange, while a new generation of veterans are reeling from depleted uranium, and they have not been taken care of. Sadly, 25% of all of the homeless men and women who sleep on our streets every night are our veterans to whom we've already broken our promise. How many more veterans does George W. Bush want to create to whom we'll yet again break our promise? Mr. President, please look at the veterans who are sleeping on the streets right across from your window in the White House. Mr. President, please take a look. Our government can monitor our cell phones, the keystrokes on our computer keyboards, the books we read at the library, but they can't give a warm meal and shelter to the veterans who have served our country and who are now in need. Something is terribly, terribly wrong. And what about the young men and women who now find themselves on the front lines, deployed in faraway places like Oman, Djibouti, Bahrain, Philippines, Uzbekistan, Colombia, Macedonia, Peru, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, 37 European countries, 12 former Soviet Union countries, 15 Asian and the Pacific countries, 21 North African and Southeast Asia countries, 27 African countries, 29 Western Hemisphere countries. George Bush signed an executive order waiving the administration's obligation to pay them their high deployment overtime pay. If he would do this to our troops when we need them most, what will he do to us? We only need Remember Florida to answer that question. And let us remember, it's easy to talk about war if you've never been to war. George Bush, Dick Cheney, Richard Paul, Paul Wolfowitz, Rush Limbaugh, where were you when your country needed you? We slid into the Vietnam War with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and it turned out not to be true. Our strength and courage is being tested right now. We can stand back and do nothing, or we can protect our republic from abuse. We are gathered here today representing every slice of America. And despite all of our differences, we are here today with one desire: to return America to her true ideals. Don't be fooled by what they may say about you. You are the true patriots. Our first President George spoke about you. He spoke about what happens to true patriots. He warned us to beware the empty, bellicose flag-waving of those who hold themselves out to be patriots. He warned us against false patriotism. He cautioned that the true patriot, the one who most loves his country, will become suspect and odious and will watch while the false patriots usurp the applause of the people. But the true patriots will know that our country's founding interests are being surrendered. That first President George was George Washington in 1796. We've known true patriots in our day, like JFK, RFK, and MLK. But you too are patriots, and today you're standing up for what is right and good about our country. Against today's backdrop of Washington, D.C., the most powerful capital on the planet, I dream of the day when the power of love replaces the power of might. That will be the day when our world will know the blessings of peace and our republic will once again be in the hands of the American people. Thank you.
U.S. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia speaking in Washington, D.C. at the Act Now to Stop the War and End Racism, or ANSWER rally. The rally brought out well over 100,000 people in Washington, D.C., but not all are opposed to the war. There was a tiny pro-war rally, as well as a few Iraqis who oppose Saddam Hussein. David Russo from the Indy Media Center in Washington, D.C., has the story.
Within the diversity of dissent amongst the 200,000 demonstrators against the U.S. war in Iraq included 57 Iraqi refugees who chartered a bus from Dearborn, Michigan, home to some 20,000 Iraqi refugees. But their message against war differed slightly from the militant anti-Bush slogans carried by others, and other Muslims took issue with what they saw as a pro-Bush, pro-interventionist position. At about 5 p.m., as buses began pulling up to return home, an ad hoc press conference started.
My name is Hisham al-Husseini, the director of Karbala Islamic Center in Dearborn, Michigan. We need election, we need freedom. We need democracy. That's all what we want. And Saddam did not come through an election. He came through brutal coup d'etat, killing, bloodshed.
Who would replace him? Who
would run for election?
Sayyid Hakim.
Well, there is Ayatollah al-Hakim one. There is doctors. There is a professor.
We came with banners and said, stop the war. Saddam is the evil man in Baghdad. And it said, Saddam and Hitler are the same. The only difference is the name. It said Saddam's a fascist, Saddam's a killer. I mean, all these basic things probably everyone knows.
Other Muslims from the U.S. and Africa debated with Husseini about his desire for U.S. military support.
But we are Iraqi people. Sure. You are Somalian. We both freedom fighters. You are against dictatorship. I am against dictatorship. So the logic says...
We got rid of them without the help of anybody.
Let me finish. Please, let me finish. No, you got rid of them? You think you are free yet? You think you have an election and democracy yet? You're joking. I can be better fighter than you in Iraq for democracy against dictatorship. You are better than me fighter in Somalia. That's what I'm saying.
So when Saddam Hussein is killed and is out... What will happen? Will the people from who are in exile in Iran come rushing back into Iraq?
People in Iran, exile, Iraqis in Iran, Iraqis in America, Iraqis in Australia, Iraqis in London, everywhere. We will go and we will run for an election.
Who's they that you're talking about?
The guy that he was here now, because he's the side of Bush. The one he was here, he was the taking a side of Bush.
So you think that Saddam Hussein should remain the leader of Iraq?
Only the Saddam Hussein should be out because of
his... Sorry, he disrespected you like that. That was so rude.
Yeah, because the people of the Iraq should, like democratically, to remove him. Bush did not have any right to do that. He did not have any right to do that. Maybe he was paying, the Bush gave him money to go and tell the people.
what they say is that it's a complete dictatorship in Iraq. No one can say anything or they're killed. There's it's so brutal and dictator that no one can dissent.
But the people have a right to...
Yes, they have the right, but they don't have the ability to do it. That's the what they're saying.
No other word have any ability or have any power to do it.
So there's already a group working against Saddam inside Iraq, but secretly. I mean, if we can get the help of the United States to at least support us to remove Saddam, we can do it. Because once one movement happens in Iraq against Saddam, I think that the people will wake up and they will go against Saddam. Because nobody likes his dictator.
With Americans, if there is an occupation afterwards, how do the Iraqi people
We will fight any
that?
Occupation, but whether it's coming go from America, yeah. We will fight any occupier. Whether it will come from east or west, we fought for freedom. We live for freedom. We will die for freedom. We don't want anybody to occupy our land. Iraq is for Iraqis people.
Right.
No matter who are they, superpower or non-superpower, we won't let nobody to occupy our land, and we mean what we say.
Should the Americans support sanctions against Iraq?
Sanction against the government of Iraq, not against the people.
How does one do that? With a dictator.
Don't sell him a weapon. Let me tell you something. I don't know if you want to tape it or not.
Tape everything.
90% of Saddam's weapons and technology is from United States. And the Congress was asking them, why did you do that? Why did you sell him?
How is it possible to separate from the dictator Saddam and the people? If we want to send food to Iraq, how do we know that it's not going to get in the hands of the government?
It's not going to work as long as Saddam is there, my brother.
Saddam Hussein.
It's not going to work as long as Saddam in power. Remove Saddam, help us remove Saddam, it'll be peace in all of it.
What is the what military strategy should the United States use to remove Saddam Hussein?
Help the Iraqi people, work with the Iraqi people, let's implement the resolution of 688 of United Nations. Help the Iraqi people, believe me, we'll liberate Iraq.
There's an army of 50,000 people in Iran that wants to come,
Iran,
and they're waiting for the right time.
All around countries, and here, everywhere. Yep. Iraqi people ready to die for their country. Freedom fighter, everywhere. So we will go to liberate our land.
Should the United States bomb Baghdad?
No. Should work with the Iraqi's opposition who knows their country and tell them where is Saddam, follow Saddam. Kill those people, but don't kill the innocent people. And we can work together through United Nations and no mistake will happen.
What would you say to a policy of a United States chosen leader for Iraq like in Afghanistan?
You mean they're going to bring us another Saddam? We will fight him again. And we will fight forever to bring freedom in Iraq, whether the dictator going to come from east or from the west. United States better help the Iraqi people to restore democracy in Iraq. But if they're going to help the Iraq to restore another dictatorship, Mr. Bush better stay in the White House.
I believe this way. I believe the people in Iraq, if they are 100% want Saddam Hussein to go on, they can do that. But I believe Saddam Hussein still have the majority support in Iraq, and these people, they are not from Iraq.
They are not from Iraq. They just got the money, and they are doing their speaking against because they want, you know, maybe they are illegal, maybe they have a, they need to live in America, they want more rights over here.
Reporting from Washington, D.C. for Pacifica's Peace Watch.
David Russo. Over 40 leaders in the peace movement spoke to upwards of 80,000 anti-war demonstrators in downtown San Francisco on Saturday. Families, labor unions, human rights advocates, punks, and 60s activists traveled from as far away as Colorado and Arizona. Peacemongers on the West Coast also demonstrated locally in Sacramento, Portland, and as many as 10,000 in Seattle. As Pauline Bartolone reports from KPFA, the rally proved that opposition to the war runs well beyond Berkeley.
Demonstrators were online for 45 minutes, waiting for mass transit from the East Bay to San Francisco. But many got a free ride as they poured out of the stations in San Francisco to join the estimated 80 to 100,000 that took to the streets to speak out against the war in Iraq on Saturday. Policemen on Market Street were casually watching protesters march by for 3 hours, most on their way to the Civic Center, to listen to some 24 spirited speakers and enjoy lunch prepared by Food Not Bombs. Some 2,000 marchers decided to continue the march through San Francisco to make their voices heard throughout the city. Although these marchers were monitored more closely by police, no arrests were made.
No blood for oil! No blood for oil!
Longtime Bay Area residents said this was the biggest anti-war demonstration since the Vietnam War. Faith Petrick is an activist in her 80s.
I've been in the Bay Area since about 1938, 39.
And how does this peace rally compare to other peace rallies that you've been to?
This is, I think, one of the biggest. I expect today is going to be one of the biggest. But I've been to labor union rallies and anti-racist rallies and anti-lynching rallies and all my life.
Protesters came from all parts of the state, including the Trent family from Grass Valley, California.
Peace for our family, peace for our country. I'm here with my daughter, Bailey, who's 7 months old, and my son, Skylar, who's 5 years old, and my husband and my great aunt, who's 85.
So why do you think it's important for families to come to rallies like this?
It's a transgenerational thing, and violence and war seem to be just a part of humanity, or people seem to think that it's part of humanity. And if you can break the cycle and teach people and teach your children that it doesn't have to be this way, then maybe there is a chance for peace.
The demonstrators at Saturday's rally were not just protesting against war in Iraq. Homemade signs bore slogans of environmental causes, in support of longshoremen, and mourning the death of Senator Paul Wellstone. All signs called for peace.
What my sign says? Well, one side says regime change starts at home, and the other one says warmongers send your children.
It says weapons inspectors to Livermore.
What does the sign say that you're wearing?
It says bikes, not bombs.
Be American, question your government, be human, support life, not death.
Same bat war, same bat media.
Choose peace and live.
Money for schools and not war.
It says blondes for peace. It's a no-brainer.
My sign says, let peace be human.
The demonstrators were unified against the Bush administration's policies. Among them, singer and activist Michael Franti.
President Bush gave us an ultimatum. He said,
got me through. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists.
I'm thinking, that's a hell of a choice. It's like McDonald's or Wendy's. Sorry, Mr. Bush, I was not with you in Bush War I, nor will I be with you in Bush War II.
At the Civic Center, leaders in the peace movement riled up the crowd. Representatives spoke from labor unions, human rights groups, and Palestinian solidarity groups. A Japanese parliament member even flew to San Francisco to deliver a speech and show solidarity with the American anti-war movement. Protesters sitting on the ground got to their feet to applaud local Congresswoman Barbara Lee.
And let me say, I introduced a resolution in Congress as an alternative to Bush, which said support a peace process, support inspections. It said no preemptive unilateral first strike. Support the United Nations. We got 72 votes on that resolution, thanks to you.
Yeah.
When they see our government supporting first strikes, how do we explain that to young people? Yeah.
Contrary to the belief of many throughout the nation, the protesters in San Francisco refuted the claim that the Bay Area is the only place in America that doesn't support the war in Iraq. Alan McAfee of San Diego.
Come to San Diego and see how many people are opposed to this war. We've been standing on street corners for more than a year with signs about peace and nonviolence, and it's amazing the number of people that go by and give a thumbs up, show a peace sign to us, and honk their horns. 2 weeks ago in San Diego, there were more than 1,000 people in that very conservative part of the country that were out.
Reporting for Peace Watch, I'm Pauline Bartolone at KPFA in Berkeley.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, it's on to Minneapolis, Seattle, and a visit with activist, singer Stephon Smith. We'll be right back.